It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. I think most people love sea otters. They're so cute. But many of us also love clams, crab, and other shellfish, and on more and more of Alaska's coast, those food sources have been depleted by rising otter numbers. We're diving into that issue on today's show. In the first half, I'm joined by a sea otter biologist to talk about the natural history, conservation, and population of otters on our coast. It's possible that the decades of abundant shellfish were an anomaly when otters had been overhunted. In the second half, we'll talk about a different view. My guest will be a Southeast Alaska native leader with news about bringing back shellfish. A hunt to support tribal use of otters in Sitka Sound seems to have boosted subsistence shellfish, and maybe that's the natural balance that existed before commercial fur hunting in the 18th century. So that's about otters. Then later in the show, we'll have our regular feature on, for endurance athletes, the training calendar with Lisa Keller. It's all coming up today on Outdoor Explorer, Alaska Public Media's audio outdoor magazine. Well, I find sea otters to be among the most interesting animals that we see in Alaska. And if you're on the coast, in Kachemak Bay, Southeast Alaska, Resurrection Bay, Prince William Sound, you see a lot of them. And their life cycle and many aspects of their life is just fascinating and unusual. And they're so fun to watch as well. So I'm excited to have my next guest, Dan Monson, who is a research biologist at USGS and has been studying sea otters for decades and knows quite a bit about them. Thanks for being here, Dan.
Yep, thank you.
So one of the things about sea otters is that they're very, very important animals in the coastal ecosystem because they eat a lot, right? I mean, they're just voraciously hungry. And when you talk about the number of calories these animals, like 70-pound animal eats, people just can't believe it.
Yes, that's all kind of due to their metabolic system. They're a very small for a marine mammal, probably is about almost as small as you can be. Can you think about the effects of water draining energy
right.
off of small body?
The larger you are, the better you can keep the heat in.
Right.
And they're small, so they got to keep
producing.
They're
small,
it,
and yeah. then they have no blubber, so mm-hmm. they don't have that layer, and they can't really store any amount of fat or energy stores, and then they have to just rely on their fur, obviously, to keep warm. And so between those things, it's simply a high energy demand lifestyle, and they have to, and they're living on a, not necessarily a high energy food source.
Yeah, so they're kind of a hummingbird of the ocean because yeah. they've just got huge metabolic needs.
Yeah.
And so they'll be devouring shellfish is like the number one thing they're after, right?
Yeah, they seem to concentrate. Their favorite prey are things like crabs, clams, sea urchins, abalone, lots of things that, of course, people like to eat also.
Yeah. They're also unique in that they really never really want to be on land. You know, seals and sea lions will haul up on rocks and sort of sun and you know, different places where you can see them. But sea otters pretty much always want to be in the water, right?
Well, it depends on, yeah, that is one of those things that's somewhat area dependent. Places like California in particular, you don't see otters hauled out very often at all. And I think part of it is the haul out habitat isn't that available and potentially, you know, the number of people on the shore might discourage it. In places up here in South Central, there's actually, it's not uncommon at all for otters to haul out. But relative to seals, yeah, it's probably a less common behavior, but it's certainly not uncommon.
Huh. What do they haul out for? What's their purpose?
Nobody's really studied haul out behavior very specifically, but you would imagine it has to be an energy saving, you know,
mm-hmm. like on behavior. A warm day.
You get out of you're getting out of the water. As soon as you get out of the water, you know, that's the loss of heat. The heat loss is much improved. So
yeah. So if you see them, often you'll see them, say, in Kachemak Bay in groups, and sometimes in eastern Prince William Sound, you see them in enormous groups. What are those groups? Are they mothers and pups? Are they males and females and pups? Or what is the social grouping of sea otters?
Well, sea otters actually are, they do have kind of this sexual segregation generally. So you'll have areas that are male areas that generally are the bachelor males. I mean, they don't form any kind of pair bonds for any length of time anyway. So the males are most of the time off from the females, and the male groups will usually have a specific general geographic area or location where they'll do their resting, and they'll, and again, it can be these large groups, and they're usually like all males. Females also in female areas will have resting locations, and they can sometimes be in fairly large numbers, usually smaller though. But in those cases, yeah, that's where you'll have females with their pups, and then usually a handful of males. The males are territorial. Once the female areas are set up, the males will kind of form their own little territories within there, and have their opportunities with the females.
So, will they defend their sort of the when they're mating with, or are they just like promiscuous?
They're very promiscuous. So the males are defending a territory, not specific females. So the females may choose them to some degree, we think. There's some evidence of that. The females may kind of choose a male area to hang out with. And once they pair bond a little bit, they can go through sometimes up to 3 days of consorting with a male and just stay with that male for those 3 days. And they mate off and on. That is one side of it. And the other side is the females keep moving around, and they may mate with several different males during that estrus period. And the males themselves aren't going to follow the female out of their territory, and they're going to just let her go, and she may go find another one. So
interesting.
It's so, kind of a wide variety.
So one of the cutest things in nature is a sea otter pup on his or her mother's tummy floating around. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just so adorable that you can't even stand it. This is a mammal where the young stay with their mother for quite a while, right?
They do. They're pretty dependent. No, they're totally dependent on their mother from birth till most weanings happen at 5-6 months of age, sometimes longer, sometimes a little shorter. But and during that time, the female's nursing them. And then once they start eating solid food, she's collecting a lot of the food for them. They can't even dive on their own until they're 5-6 weeks old at least.
They're kind of too buoyant to dive, right?
They're too buoyant to dive. That pup pelage is so buoyant, and it is pretty humorous to watch some of these juveniles trying to dive sometimes, and they can only get their head down, and their feet are sticking above the water, kicking around, and they can't get underwater. So it's pretty fun to watch.
Yeah, and they only have one at a time?
One at a time. There's no way they could handle two at a time and successfully raise. There's occasional reports of twins being born, none that I know of that have ever been successful. If a twin is born, one of them won't make it, and they have to hold. In fact, it's critical for for that pup to be able to ride on the belly like they do and be out of the water when they're that young.
Because otherwise they'll get too
cold. Otherwise they're just going to get too cold. So, and part of the, well, I could get into it later in terms of their life history, in terms of as populations reach carrying capacity and food becomes more limiting, females have harder time being able to just keep their pup up out of the water for long enough. And so pup mortality tends to increase as resources get a little bit limited.
So that becomes a limiting factor
right,
for them.
But when there's lots of food, the females actually tend to, well, even when there's, no matter what the conditions, they tend to fatten up during pregnancy, so that first, even though sea otters can't store a lot of energy, the first few days after birth, they try to minimize their feeding as much as possible and literally just keep that pup on their belly almost 24 hours a day.
You know, it seems like an animal that would have a hard time recovering from a population loss, because one pup at a time, a lot of rearing, and we know that before Russians came to North America after 1741, there were extraordinary numbers of otters. And if you read some of those early descriptions, they talk about, pushing their boats through rafts of otters to get to shore. Then they hunted those down to almost nothing, almost completely annihilated the animals until they were protected at the beginning of the 20th century. And it was really, I've read that even in the 1960s, most people around here had not seen an otter. It was really, in the last 40, 50 years that they've come roaring back. So was that a period, that whole 20th century period, the time of just continuously increasing population, a slow rise?
Yep, that's pretty much it. The once protections kind of came in the early 1900s, Yeah, the sea otters are finally allowed to start rebounding, but you're right. It's their maximum growth rate, population growth rate, is somewhere around 20% a year. And, you know, that would be under ideal conditions. And so then these populations would expand. And the Aleutians was where they probably, you know, were first studied and thought and watched the population expand like that. Carl Kenyon out in Amchitka, if you've ever read his monograph, did some of the earliest work and some really complete, you know, work, and watched that population kind of hit carrying capacity and then stabilize.
Was that the sort of the one refuge of survival that it sort of seeded everything
else? Yeah, that was one of the remnant colonies, was out at Amchitka Island, one of about 12 throughout their range. Another one was places like Shuyak Island at the north end, a little place called Latex Rocks on the north end of Kodiak Island.
Huh.
Other places, there was a little population left in western Prince William Sound. So these little pockets that survived were the ones that expanded out. And places like, say, Ketchumak Bay, that was one of the places they were eliminated, and they didn't, like you were saying. And I think the reason people don't think about them as really being very abundant is because places like Ketchumak Bay, where there's a lot of people that see them, really didn't have otters until into the 70s and 80s. That's when that population really started to take off, and now is really just starting to hit its kind of maximum numbers in the last probably decade.
Yeah. And I want to talk a lot more about that, about sort of like how many otters is the right number. But there's a lot more to talk about it, sort of about their life cycle. Really have a great expert here to talk about it. Dan Munson is a research wildlife biologist at USGS and has been studying sea otters in our part of the world for many, many years. How long does an otter live? I mean, they take a while for them to reproduce, but once they're going, they live a while, right?
Yeah, they're about 20 years is maybe a maximum lifespan, probably on average more like a 15-year-old for female and maybe a little younger for males. And yeah, they're not reproducing until they're 3 to 4 years old. So that's probably a 10 to 13, you know, 14, 15-year reproductive span, lifespan.
Mm-hmm. And do they pretty much stay in the same place during the 20 years, or will they go like to a different bay, or how much do they move around?
They have a relatively small home range as kind of marine mammals go. They tend to have a couple, three centers of activity, we call it. And they may spend a few weeks in one, and it's going to be a fairly small area, and then sometimes move to another one that could be up to sometimes several kilometers away. But overall, it's probably their whole entire home range might be within a 10 to 15 kilometer radius. But within that area, you know, they're going to spend most of their time in a few small places. Mm-hmm. And so they are pretty limited.
I felt that way down at my cabin, is that you would see them. You'd see kind of the same otter for a few years. You know, you could tell him by his face and oh, there he is again, you know, and he just seemed to hang out in our little cove.
Especially males. Now, that's probably, you're talking about a territorial male, and the territorial males can have sometimes the smallest territories. They pick a spot and they stay there. And they also, it's a continuum from males that tend to move around a lot, and I kind of call them sneaker males. They look for mating opportunities wherever they can, and they don't really hold territories, to these really solidly territorial males who I tracked one in Amchitka that spent 3 years there that I had him tagged, and he never left an area that was probably the size of a football field or two.
Wow.
I mean, he was always there. And then there's variation in between. There's seasonal territories where sometimes females tend to be in some places in the wintertime, and as soon as there's females there, the males will, some male will decide it's a mm-hmm. territory for as long as they're there. And then once the females are gone, he may move back to the male area and just hang out again. So there's a whole variety of strategies if you're a male.
Yeah. Well, and this idea of territory and where they want to be, I've heard that as the numbers were coming back, some of the studies that were done in like the 60s and 70s said, well, otters like to be in kelp forests and like to eat sea urchins. And then it's a few more decades passed and the numbers went up. We realized, no, actually, they like a lot of places, right?
That's true. And I think a lot of that comes from the fact that a lot of the earliest work on sea otters came from the Aleutians, where that paradigm really holds true. The otters, when there's no otters around, after they were eliminated by the harvest, by the hunting, the urchins, which could become super abundant out in the Aleutians, pretty much they created what they called urchin barrens. So the kelps, they just overgrazed the kelp, and the urchins were thick. And then the sea otters came back and eliminated this, or way decreased the amount of sea urchin grazing pressure. The kelps came back, and the sea otters utilized that kelp oftentimes for resting and stuff. But the fact is, kelp isn't necessary to be. If you're an otter, you don't need kelp. It's kind of a byproduct of the fact that they eat a lot of urchins. But they live in a lot of habitats where things like clams and such are their main prey. And there isn't necessarily kelps even after they're there for a while, because kelps, it's just not kelp habitat. Mm-hmm. And then they just do fine in those situations.
You kind of
have
to rewrite the textbooks, right? I remember learning ecology as a kid, like, well, you've got the kelp, and then that gives you the urchins, and then the otters keep down the kelp, and that help, or keep down the urchins, and that helps the kelp. And then they use the kelp as an anchor and wrap around, and it's sort of like this nice little story that all fits together. And mm-hmm. then you find out, well, that's just one thing they do. Can do something else.
That's true. Yeah. That's true.
Yeah. So as we've seen them spread into more habitat, we've seen them eat more of the kinds of resources that people want. Most Alaskans would probably say otters can eat all the urchins they want. But when it comes to crabs and clams, you know, we care a bit more. And so we've seen the clam availability and crab availability go way down in places where otter population went up over the last few decades. And some people see that as a problem. It sounds like, from what you're saying, the otters may just be returning to their natural abundance.
Yep, that's true. And if you want to think about the whole history of the otter, you know, they really are a species that is what we call K-selected. They evolved to live at carrying capacity and at kind of in, you know, they say the balance, you might say, with their resources. So the idea that, you know, how many is too many? Have they decimated their resources? I never like to use that mm-hmm. word, because, you know, they are an animal that has a huge effect on their ecosystem. That's what we know. And that means their primary prey get reduced in number and reduced in size. That there's no doubt. And the fact that it's hard to have some of these fisheries with that is you know, not
just
surprising.
Just not enough clams.
But those fisheries wouldn't have been there had there been an otter population that had stayed, you know, throughout history instead of being eliminated. And once that population was eliminated, all of these invertebrate prey resources just exploded to, you know, I guess you would say unnatural levels, or at least not natural in terms of if the sea otter had been in place and doing its thing in the ecosystem. So we just got used to that, and now we're seeing what it probably, you know, was like before those otters were eliminated.
Right. So if you talk to an old timer who says, well, things aren't like they used to be around here. We used to be able to get all these crab for dinner, and we could get our limit of clams, you know, in one tide and all that. They're really remembering a time that was unnatural in one sense, and that the otters had been eliminated, and that's why all the shellfish were there.
That's probably true. But I'm not really going to get into the management aspect of mm-hmm. sea otters, but I mean, I guess the one thought on that is, if you want to think about humans interacting with their environment, I mean, there's going to be always the argument that, okay, it was natural for the otters to be here, but people are part of the environment, and we always have been. And, you know, even in probably native cultures, there could have been some amount of local control.
Right. We don't know how much the indigenous people were doing.
Right. There's mm-hmm. there's some evidence in middens and things where we think there could have been some amount of local control, even by earlier native cultures.
Very little use of otter now, even though Alaska natives can kill otter mm-hmm. as, for subsistence, but I've been told that they don't taste good. You're not really edible.
I can't imagine they would be. They are a mustelid, and generally they're not considered a very tasty resource.
Yeah. So we were talking about the way otters affect their environment. And one way is when they eat the urchins, that causes more kelp. And you were saying that that has a broader effect too, right?
Right. There's lots of indirect effects and kind of, but also in the sense of what we call ecosystem services. And so, you know, that increase in kelp increases biodiversity within the system just because there's a more complex habitat. But in the idea of ecosystem services, that kelp is also tying up carbon. And so there's actually been...
Climate change carbon.
Think about, you know, actually sequestering carbon is, of course, there's even research out there. How can we kind of tie it up more and pull it out of the system? Well, of course, trees and all plants store carbon. That's probably our main carbon source, our storage. And kelps, of course, are really fast growing, and they store a lot of carbon also. And there's been a paper that was written in 2012, Wilmars et al., that estimated that 4.4 to 8.7 million metric tons per year of carbon is tied up in kelps. This is from Vancouver to Attu, kind of the Aleutian Range, and BC to the Aleutian Range. That much carbon is extra tied up every year in this kelp production because of sea otters. And if they weren't there, that wouldn't be tied up.
That's incredible.
Yeah, that's a lot. And they estimated at the time at $250 to $408 million worth of, you know, American dollars on the European carbon exchange.
$400 million of carbon just from having otters there.
Yeah.
It's amazing. So the thing that is limiting the otters then is the food supply for the most part and whatever predation, but get into that in a minute. Some species that are sort of in a sort of food supply balance will have a crash followed by a boom and then a crash and a boom, and then that's their pattern. Do we know what the otter pattern is? Is it more of an equilibrium, or is it possibly that sort of boom and bust that we see from some other animals?
The research on that is maybe not totally out there yet, because so many places still have habitat left to expand into. Mm-hmm. And so really, until all the habitat is completely reoccupied, it's hard to have a kind of an overshoot, because they always can move to... I mean, the one time otters are a little more mobile is in this expanding range situation. So as a particular area becomes a little more heavily used and resources start to become more limiting, they can move on to the next area. Mm-hmm. And there's still many situations around their range where that's still the case. And so we haven't seen very many places yet where they've kind of hit carrying capacity and then they didn't have anywhere else to go. Amchitka, though, is one of those places that we've got, and Carl Kenyon was working on sea otters in the 50s and 60s when that population was kind of reaching carrying capacity. And the population data itself is not probably precise enough to know how much they may have overshot, say, the capacity of the environment. But what we do know is, of course, mortality did go up when they hit carrying capacity. But at the same time, they are able to switch to do new prey resources and then stabilize at a fairly even number. So as the population increased, and again, this whole idea of they ate the urchins, the kelp came back. Well, that kelp, in return, provided lots of fish-rearing habitat. And so the kind of the biodiversity of fish species probably increased to some degree, and certainly increased the amount of fish available, especially nearshore demersal-type fishes. And sea otters switched to start feeding on fish out there in the Aleutians, and then that became kind of a new resource for them that they, again, kind of reached this equilibrium.
So it's all still a big experiment, in a sense.
It is. Yeah. It really is.
Well, the other thing that's we've seen is a loss of sea otters in the outer Aleutians, which now there's a pretty strong theory that is caused by predation on otters, right?
That's correct. And so when I actually was doing my master's work out in Amchitka, that's where I did my master's work, was out in Amchitka in the early 1990s. I went there initially trying to look at the demographics of a sea otter population that we thought was at carrying capacity. So we thought even at that time there was lots of animals, and you know, we should be observing kind of survival and reproductive rates of a at K population. Well, we kind of figured out midway through and afterwards that actually the population was already in decline. It wasn't really obvious at first, but it became obvious, and within a decade of when I finished out there, the population had crashed by about 90%. And so we started looking into why that could be. My main advisor at that time, Jim Estes, was kind of the lead in that. And we've looked at pretty much what could cause such a huge decline. So this decline happened from Attu all the way to the Alaska Peninsula.
So it can't be like one pollution event or something like that.
It's not, yeah. There's not like a point source, yeah. A pollution type thing. Mm-hmm. Or a contaminants thing from, say, a base that was out there. Mm-hmm. That doesn't make any sense. We looked for things like diseases, but for one, we couldn't hardly ever find a fresh dead otter on the beach. You never really found very many. You know, one thing about
if
Carl,
they were dying off in those numbers, there should have been a few corpses.
Exactly. Right? Carl mm-hmm. Kenyon's documentation of this population reaching carrying capacity, in fact, one of the characteristics was that he started finding, you know, these starved animals, mostly young and old, that started showing up more commonly on the beach. Well, we weren't seeing that at all. In fact, we hardly ever found fresh carcasses. Most of everything we found was old and been laying there for a long time. So disease didn't necessarily make any sense, plus disease, again, over such a wide area doesn't really fit. So the only thing that seem to fit is that killer whales are responsible, and we kind of came on that partly because someone actually noticed a killer whale eat an animal, and we put a little paper together at some point that tried to document how many killer whale predation events we had actually seen. And then we did a little math and found out that even though we'd rarely see it, if it's happening at the rate that could explain the decline, we saw about how many we should have seen based on how much time we'd spent watching.
Right.
So that was consistent with the idea that killer whales could be causing it. And the final, two other pieces of evidence that were really strongly implicated is there was a population that we had been actually studying for a while at Adak Island in a little lagoon, and Clam Lagoon, it's called. That population is not very big. It's about around 100 animals. It's not a big place. That population stayed stable through this whole decline.
Mm.
Right outside this lagoon, the population crashed.
Because the whales couldn't get in there.
And that lagoon is inaccessible to killer whales.
Interesting. So I guess it begs the question of why the killer whales aren't eating the all the otters in Kachemak Bay or in Prince William Sound, where the otters are becoming so plentiful.
Well, that is consistent with the idea that killer whales are specialists, and they have kind of a inertia in their prey selection.
Mm-hmm.
So
they're cultural.
They're cultural, and what it tells me is that this decline isn't due to just killer whales in general. It's probably due to one pod that decided to switch, and so the decline is within the range of probably one pod of killer whales moving around in the Aleutians. And that is also consistent with, there was a paper that was also written about the energetics and what it would, how much,
they
again,
need to eat a lot of
how
them.
Much,
yeah.
How much would you need to eat if you're a killer whale, considering that otters aren't very energetically valuable.
Yeah.
They're kind of like popcorn.
They're pretty lean.
They're like the popcorn of the killer whale food. And in fact, four killer whales could have explained the whole decline.
Wow. That is so interesting. So it really, we think of there being this balance of nature, but really there, if some other killer whales take it into their mind to eat sea otter somewhere else, then
they're easy pickings.
They could wipe out or greatly reduce those numbers, and back come the clams and the.
That's true.
Just don't count on anything.
You don't count on it, but it's certainly it's a possibility.
Right. Well, I mean, in nature, don't count on anything staying the same.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, that's true. Change is normal, actually.
Yeah.
So
fascinating.
And in thinking again of the final piece of evidence, I think that points to killer whales and this whole idea of that they're out there, and that in general, a sea otter is an easy target for a killer whale, and they often spend a lot of time offshore, you know, within a kilometer or two of shore, but
around,
you know, they're just bobbing around. The animals that are left in the Aleutians are tucked in up on the shore and in the little cracks and crevices, and they don't wander offshore. They're hardly, you hardly ever see one more than 100 meters offshore anymore. And as someone who catches sea otters, one of our methods for catching sea otters is actually a dive technique, and we go down and with traps and we come up underneath animals and catch them. Well, in most places, if you miss an animal, they dive and swim off into open water. And that's the way they used to be in the Aleutians when I first started there in the early 90s. Now, if you go out there, if you try to catch one and you miss it, they're already in such shallow water, it's hard to even get under them. And then if you miss one, they jump up onto the rocks.
Yeah.
And so they have totally switched their behavior and
out.
Their distribution. And that, to me, is one of the strongest pieces of evidence that this is something from offshore that is
interesting.
Created this decline.
Well, fascinating topic. I really want to thank you for coming in, Dan. Really, we could talk for hours on this topic.
Yes, probably.
Yeah. Dan Monson, research wildlife biologist for USGS. Thanks so much for being on Outdoor Explorer.
Thank you for having me.
Stay with us. More about otters on today's show.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Well, welcome back. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth, and today we are talking about sea otters. Everybody thinks they're extremely cute, but they also have quite an impact on the ecosystem, a keystone species and a voracious appetite. And that's caused the disappearance, at least in our lifetimes, or great reduction in a lot of shellfish that people like to eat. And so it's happened in Southeast Alaska as well, and there's been some action to kind of address the issue. And that's what we're going to be hearing about in this segment. Mike Miller is a subsistence fisherman in Sitka. He's a member of the Sitka Tribal Council, and he's chair of the Indigenous Peoples Council on Marine Mammals, which is a statewide organization. And we reached him by phone from down in Southeast Alaska. Thanks for being with us, Mike.
Yeah, good morning.
So it sounds like in northern Southeast Alaska, the situation is pretty similar to what we've seen here in South Central Alaska, with large numbers of otters and then reductions in numbers of shellfish that you would have harvested for subsistence over the years. What was that? When did that take place, and what kinds of changes did you see in terms of the ecosystem as otters increased?
Well, we saw actually the sea otters in Southeast Alaska back up a little bit. They were essentially wiped out for a great many years after the ban on marine mammal hunting, I think in 1911. The otters in Southeast actually come from the Amchitka area because they were transplants during the earlier nuclear tests in the Aleutians. And so there was...
That's a funny piece of history, isn't it? When they blew off that big bomb on Amchitka back in the 1970s, they took some of the otters and brought them to Southeast Alaska, I guess, to thinking they might blow them up or something.
Right. Well, I think it was an effort by the state of Alaska at that point to work, and it was some of the early environmental movement to, if they were going to blow up the island, I think they made the effort to take the otters out of there, and that actually was the seed for reintroducing otters into Southeast, and there was, I think, at least three or four sites where they were released, and the numbers stayed pretty low for a long time, and I think it was the late 60s when they actually did this. In the Sitka area proper, when we started to see the effects of large numbers of otters, would have been the late 80s to early 90s, and up till that point, up until the mid-90s, it was commonplace for folks locally to not even have to dive to get abalones and gumboots. It would just be a tidal event each year on the first, especially the first low tides in the spring and early summer. You'd see everybody out climbing around on the rocks, picking abalone primarily. And of course,
when the tide is out, the table is set, and you just go down in that lower intertidal, and there's all kinds of food there, right?
There you go. Yep. So, but you know, you'd see also the other things like urchins, red and green urchins, and to a lesser extent, sea cucumbers and other things. And of course, Dungeness is a big food that the tribal folks, well, everybody eats. So it was, going along fine. And then when the otters, we kind of watched a north to south progression on the big population, at least in the Sitka area. And as they moved south, they left a pretty barren wasteland behind them, so they're very effective at eating a lot of the things that people like to eat, and were important commercial species as well. So I think everybody was affected and kind of across the board. Although there was, the plus side, I guess there was a lot of tourism that centered at that time around people getting to see sea otters, and that was something that we always keep in mind as well, is that something important for people to be able to see them too. I would say roughly around the late 90s is when we couldn't really find abalone, especially in Sitka Sound. They just were, for all practical purposes, it seemed like they were gone completely. Interesting, though, because the otter population actually was quite a bit higher in the mid-90s than it stabilized out to in the 2000s. 2003 time frame, and it was quite a bit less otters. I think they essentially kind of ate their food source and either continued south or just the reproduction rate slowed down.
They might have overshot the carrying capacity there, but then there was more territory for them to spread out in, and so presumably they spread. But then the numbers of your shellfish still stayed pretty low, right? I mean, it didn't
correct.
Yeah. You guys started thinking about what you could do about this problem at some point.
Well, we've looked at it quite a bit in the past. That's why we started in 2006, started a tannery to try to promote economic opportunity for folks to use the sea otter skins. And then progressively, as that grew, we've worked with Fish and Wildlife Service to, in 2012, to clarify language as it relates to handicrafts, and there was a lot of confusion as to what was allowed, and it was very interpretive. So we did work with Fish and Wildlife Service and a mix of handicraft people from around the state that work on sea otters, from Bristol Bay, like Port Hyde and places like that, to Aleutians, South Central and Kodiak down to Southeast. And in a couple of days, we came out with language that's not perfect, but it's really helped, I think, in people being more comfortable working with the fur.
So just to make sure the listeners understand what we're talking about, the Marine Mammal Act passed back in the 1970s, and it said that indigenous people could continue to do their traditional use of marine mammals, even though other folks couldn't harvest them. But there wasn't that much use of sea otters. I mean, the use of sea otters probably happened a lot back in the early days before contact, right, back in like the 18th century, but that had kind of fallen out of use because the otters weren't there. And so what you're talking about is kind of bringing back some of that, right?
Right, correct. So obviously the use of sea otters, whether it was pelt sales, I think was the primary driver, but that's why sea otters essentially disappeared from the ecosystems in most places, except for a few remnant populations in the Aleutians. We looked at it and I think in about 2012, we started working closely with Sea Alaska Heritage Foundation, which is a nonprofit branch of Sea Alaska Corporation. So we do a lot of education programs and cultural programs at Sea Alaska Heritage. And we looked at revitalizing, essentially, its art form, of course. And I think we looked at our rural communities that lost a lot of income from lack of timber and lack of fishing opportunities that they relied on for the last 20 years. And we saw the otters as a essentially a renewable resource, for folks to be able to make really nice, quality handicrafts, because it is exceptional fur, of course. But we felt if we did it in a controlled way, by directing harvest in certain areas that had high otter abundance, and then bringing the furs for classes to the communities that don't have that many otters, was somewhat of a win-win situation, but it inadvertently turned up being more of a management plan than we thought. And so starting in 2012, 13, 14, we had a big target of hunting in the Sitka area, partially due to the tannery location. But just, I think we had more hunters that were here, and once they were able to move the product, in that case, the pelts for the classes, we saw a dramatic increase and saw a bit over 1,000 otters taken out of Sitka Sound in a three-year period. What we didn't really plan for was started to be borne out in about 2016, just a couple years ago, and we actually started seeing things like gumboots and abalone show back up in really good numbers, and a lot of the abalones were two-year-old abalones. So it's we're working this summer to hopefully get a project to document that better. We do have the tag information and the hunting times for the otters, but it's an interesting twist that we hadn't anticipated, because there still are otters here.
It seems like you solved two problems at once there. I'm going to just let folks know this is Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth, and we're talking with Mike Miller, who's a subsistence fisherman in Sitka area, is a member of the Sitka Tribal Council and chair of the Indigenous Peoples Council of Marine Mammals. And as you've heard, they've started back up hunting otters and using them for traditional handicrafts, and have had an impact on bringing back some of their shellfish in that area. Mike, I'm interested in what sort of handicrafts are being used, and what's the market for these in terms of after you've used the pelts?
Well, the primary ones that we see people making are the scarves, the hats, the gloves, and to a lesser extent, we're starting to see people more in making vests and using fur as trim for other products. So it's essentially limitless, as long as you're not trying to sell a product that's just a raw piece of fur that's been tanned. But once it's essentially turned into any kind of product, it's kind of open to interpretation at that point for the handicrafter to see what they want to make. I've seen everything from card holders to wallet covers to cell phone covers. So there's a wide range, and the demand, of course, is kind of the challenge, though, because oftentimes for our people that make handicrafts, is they have a hard time getting the product out, and more in a nationwide, which the sale, of course, is allowed in the U.S. To anybody once it's turned into a handicraft. Oftentimes, our folks end up trying to sell it within Alaska, and that market gets it continues to be there, but it's certainly not on the level that we've seen the interest in the lower 48 for people to buy product. So I know the Alaska Heritage did take product down to, I think, a safari club show and the Indian Arts and Crafts Market in Santa Fe, and it just had tremendous interest in the product. But we are continuing to look at the last phase of that kind of project, and that's to assist people in marketing the product.
Finding where to sell it.
There's always challenges in that. I know I think it was Etsy that a few months ago did a ban on sea otter products, or I think all marine mammal products. And obviously, both with ivory and other marine mammal parts, we're seeing some states start to ban the use of them. The ivory issue, of course, is tied to elephant ivory, and they just lump ivory together. And when they do that, they, at least like I think in some of the communities in California, they've just said any marine mammal at that point. And so it's a bit of a challenge educating folks that they're not endangered in Southeast Alaska or South Central. And the hunts are closely monitored, because each animal has to be tagged within 30 days of the harvest. So it's
and it's not like you're eliminating the otters. In fact, if we look back into, prehistory, probably the Tlingit people were using quite a few otters. So you might even be returning them to the ecological balance that would have existed prior to the arrival of the Russians. And I'm just interested in what you'd say to that theory, because one of the things we've talked about on the show is, yeah, there's a lot of otters, but maybe maybe what we were used to back in the, you know, the 70s was abnormal, and now we're returning more to normal. But also, Native people were using the otters back before contact, and so maybe Native use is actually bringing us back more to a normal balance. Address that, if you would.
Well, it could very well be the case, and of course, you know, there's kind of a blank spot in history, but I'm aware of at least elder interviews that were done quite some time ago that referenced that there was essentially management of otters in the past, and especially if they got into ecologically important nursery areas for crab, or I'm not quite sure how they would have done it in other areas, but if they were important harvesting areas from the subsistence standpoint or cultural use, that there was some effort to keep the otters out of certain areas. And it is interesting, at least in this case, is again that the otters aren't wiped out. So there's still plenty of opportunities for people to see otters, but we're looking at a project right now that hopefully we can quantify it a bit more so people can see the impacts. And again, when you get, there is evidence, at least in previous studies, that when you get to a more stable population, the otters become more selective in their diets, and that there are otters that kind of focus on just single species. And potentially we just have otters here that aren't abalone eaters or gumboot eaters, but those are in other areas that those studies have shown that, but we're quite anxious to look at the situation here and try to make some connections.
Yeah. So this hunt that you did in Sitka Sound, which removed about 1,000 otters over a period of years, and then you started to see shellfish returning, has that return of the shellfish been enough to really reinvigorate your subsistence usage of that area?
Well, you know, that's one of the things that we're going to try to figure out. And of course, I think everybody started seeing, not everybody, but you know, quite a few people started seeing for abalone after 15 years of not even looking. And so we are aware of dive surveys that happened in 2010 timeframe where they saw zero abalone. And so it's interesting as they come back, because it's kind of a secret amongst people, because nobody wants other people to know
that
they're out there. So we're going to have to sit down this summer and interview a few people that we know are usual shellfish harvesters, and potentially some of the dive fishermen that dive for other species, and try to pull together a more comprehensive picture of what people are seeing, because there's kind of traditionally favorite picking spots that everybody has their own spot, right? And it's as of last year, we started hearing from other people that had, you know, abalone back in their favorite spot. So it's still a bit sketchy, you know, of how big the population is coming back, but just the fact that there was apparently a remnant population someplace that has already started seeing the impacts, and we're seeing people start to pick them again. But also, red urchins and green urchins and gumboots, of course, are, you know, important species both on the commercial side and the subsistence side. So the scope of it at this point, we're not quite sure, but we're hoping to get enough information to potentially find the funding to target another community in Southeast and see if we can replicate the same scenario.
I see. Yeah, that's exciting. So as you look into the future, you're doing this study to actually figure out what impact you're having, but also think about areas where you want to control otters, or at least bring otters into more of a balance with the ecosystem, maybe areas that are particularly of high subsistence value, and spread it in that way. Is that right?
Yeah, correct. And so the MMPA does allow for essentially harvest management plans to be enacted by people that qualify. So it'd be tribal communities essentially would qualify for that. But to be honest, we for a long time, I think, looked at that as saying that they essentially have to have no otter zones, you know, and that was a bit controversial for some folks. But what we're seeing here is that we didn't have to wipe out all the otters to have the impact on the resources. So it might be unique to the geologic features of the sound here. You know, there's several of these questions that we're just not quite sure, but at least it provides a direction to go that we actually could get started on, provided we get the funding, of course, that we could get started on as early as this year. Well, a lot of the other solutions are lengthy battles about language in the MNPA or who gets to manage what, and those often drag on, and the otters aren't stopping, growing the population or grazing the ocean. So it's, I think, a positive step that bids start back up here in a short period of time.
Great. Well, thank you for telling us about it, Mike. It's a really fascinating topic and kind of interesting to see that you have maybe found a new avenue to deal with this problem. And so I appreciate your being on the show with us. Mike Miller, he's a member of the Sitka Tribal Council and a fisherman down in Sitka working on the sea otter issue. Thanks for being with us.
Great. Yeah, thanks for the time.
All right. Stick with us as Outdoor Explorer continues. It's time for our training calendar, and in the studio with me right now is Lisa Keller of Multisport Training of Alaska. She's been with us once a month for the last 6 months, because training for an endurance event is not a short-term thing. It's something you think about far in advance, and Lisa's been sort of working through that with us for different events. And Lisa, we've got the Mayor's Marathon coming up on the solstice, so that's about 6 weeks from now.
Correct.
Marathon, half marathon. Where would folks want to be for that?
Well, you've definitely gotten to where you're doing your last long runs. And the importance of that is that you're doing a lot of time on those long runs at your race pace. So I think that's kind of what a lot of people miss, is in this final build to the race, is that they might go out and do long runs, but they're not putting race pace in there. So they're doing long, slow runs.
Mm.
And, you know, there's that theory that if you run slow, you're going to race slow too. Not just a theory, but that's how it happens. So it's really important to be putting some time at the beginning, some time at the in the middle, and some time at the end of your race, long runs, putting them at race pace so that you get used to that.
Is it psychological or physical or both?
Well, definitely both. You have to train your body specifically to do what you want it to do that day.
To do the energy output that you're looking for.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And to really know that pace. That's really, for new runners, one of the hardest things to learn is what the pace they're going to run in the race feels like. I was out today coaching at my group at Highland Prison, my women prisoners, and my top runner out there, that's what she's really struggling with right now as a new runner who's really fast. But she can run really fast intervals, but that's not necessarily what we want her to do to train her for pace. So she has to learn how to hold herself back. Mm-hmm. And I think that tends to be one of the hardest things for newbies to learn.
The pacing and getting up to pace.
Exactly.
So that you really are ready on race day and it's not brand new to you.
Right. Because that would be, if you've been doing, you know, your runs 2 minutes, 1 to 2 minutes slower per mile than you plan on racing, then you are not really prepared to race at what you want your goal to be.
Right. So let's talk about goals.
Mm-hmm.
A goal for a marathon or a goal for a half marathon.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of what how do you set your race goals?
One of the ways you can set race goals is by shorter races. So if you did the Heart Run or you did another shorter race, then there are lots of online calculators that you can go plug that time in, and it will tell you if you've been training for a marathon or a half marathon, what kind of time you can expect to get for that based on what your last race was. So that's a really great way to do it. You can also do it by doing a 2 mile time trial, which is 4 or 8 times around one of the tracks in town, and then also plug that time into an online calculator and it will tell you what to expect. Then you should really not just
sort of Google race goal pace or something like that.
Race goal pace. Mm-hmm. I mean, any of those things. I think Runner's World has some great resources around that. So that's always a great place to go for information. But you should also set a range of goals. So you don't want to just say, I'm going to run a 3:59 marathon. You don't want to say you're going to run a 4-hour marathon, but you're going to run a 3:59 marathon. But you would put a goal, a range of goals in there, maybe from 3:50 to 4:10. Like, I'm going to be really disappointed if I'm over 4:10. But best day ever, I run 3:50. And so you give yourself a little bit of space to move in there.
And that's about making sure that you have a positive experience to some extent, right? If you always set these stretch goals and never make them, then you're always bummed out.
Exactly. And the way you figure out those goals, again, is going back and being realistic about it and plugging it into a race calendar and figure out what you've done in the past. You can't just come up like, if you've only done a half marathon at 2 hours, you're not all of a sudden going to run a marathon in 3 hours. So you have to be realistic too.
Right. So you set these goals and then things happen that you don't expect. And we had a great example of this in the Boston Marathon this year, mm-hmm. where it was really cold and rainy, and wow, an American woman won in the first time in such a long time. And hearing her interview, it sounds like she didn't even think she could stick with the race. She was ready to give up.
Right. I think the great thing about her is she just kind of set little mini goals during the race while it was happening. And that's what I think you have to be ready to do, is kind of revise your goals during the race itself. So if conditions are really bad, and she was just thinking, I'm just going to help Shalane Flanagan get, you know, to 5 miles or to 10 miles or bring her up from the bathroom, you know, because she had to make a bathroom stop. And so she set all these little goals all along thinking, well, I'll drop out at this point. And she got to that point and she was okay. Okay, I'll drop out at this point. She got to that point and she was okay. So she didn't just stop and say, I'm giving up. Instead, she started to revise her goals, and lucky for her, you know, she managed to be the one who outlasted everybody else in those poor conditions.
Yeah. What do you think that's all about? The fact that Americans are just more used to running in bad conditions?
Well, I think that's part of it. I was reading a lot about it this past week, and the pro-American women were saying when they train with the Africans, the Africans are so used to having such great weather conditions that, you know, if it's just like misting rain out, they won't go out and run in it. They'll wait. Whereas Americans, almost anywhere in the United States you are, at some point you're going to have bad weather. That either you're going to have to spend a month on a treadmill, or you're going to get outside and you know, and power through it in bad weather.
Especially if you live in Anchorage.
Right. I think it was great. There were so many, like 40 Alaskans, I think, at Boston this year. And, you know, everybody got there and they did the race. They didn't give up and just sit in the hotel room and, you know, watch TV. They actually went out and did it. And not everybody was happy with their times. There was one PR that I actually know of where somebody finished faster than her qualifying time. And that was great. But, you know, we're used to dealing with those bad conditions.
I mean, for us, those are kind of normal conditions in a way. I mean, the people out there might be thinking 70 is great, but for us, that would be very hot.
Yes. Yeah. I think I talked to someone I knew this morning about it, and she said the big thing about it is you ended up with about 10 pounds of clothing on you because it was so wet that you ended up with your clothes just soaked and there was just no way to stay warm. So I think it was a little bit unusual even for us. But they all got out there and did it.
Yeah. So is that, I guess that's not something you can train for. That's just about being adaptable, running out, doing stuff in all conditions, and not giving up. And as you say, setting your goal 1 mile at a time. Don't just get stuck on the far horizon. So all right. Great advice. Good advice for life, too.
It is.
All right. Thanks, Lisa. We'll be back next month again with Lisa Keller for the training calendar. She has Multisport Training of Alaska. She trains folks to do endurance races, and she's been kind enough to come in and tell us about it on Outdoor Explorer. Thanks for being here, Lisa.
Yeah, thank you, Charles.
That's all for today's show. I want to thank my guests in the first half, Dan Monson, who is a research wildlife biologist at the USGS Alaska Science Center. And then we heard from Mike Miller with the Sitka Tribal Council. And Lisa Keller from Multisport Training of Alaska gave us the training calendar. Our producer is Eric Bork. Assistant producer is Hannah Duro. My name is Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.